Welcome to the series Security Strategies in Government, sponsored by Anomaly on Federal News Network. I'm your host, Scott Massioni, and my guest today is Jill Cagliostro, Product Manager at Anomaly. Jill, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So we're talking a lot about threat. We're talking about intelligence and a lot of the whole cyber landscape going on today. And so, Jill, let's start off with the Iran situation. It's extremely volatile right now. So can you tell us just a little bit about the possible threats that are within Iran and how the U.S. kind of warns about these threats?
Yeah, so there's, you know, a lot of geopolitical issues going on right now between Iran and the U.S. directly. You know, we had the assassination of General Soleimani, which kind of kicked things off to be a little bit more extreme than they were before, right? Really heightened the level of threat that we're seeing. And after the assassination, we actually saw a huge uptick in cyber activity out of Iran. And so, you know, obviously following the assassination, Iran chose to target two Iraqi military bases that held U.S. forces. But what's interesting about it is that even though they targeted those sites, there was no loss of life on the United States side. And so what that kind of shows is that I think where we see a bigger risk from Iran right now in terms of capabilities is actually on the cyber front. And this shows how war has evolved. Right? It used to be very focused on your kinetic power, nuclear power, being able to attack on the ground. But as we've become more of an interconnected global world, all connected by the internet, that became a higher risk target. And the barrier for entry is much lower, right? To be able to win a kinetic war, it's very expensive. You have to have humans to be able to physically carry out the attacks. You have to have a variety of technologies to be able to effectively combat your enemy. But in the cyberspace, the barrier for entry is much lower. You need a computer and an internet connection.
Right.
And from there, you can cause a lot of destruction.
So what sort of capabilities does Iran have? I mean, you said that all you really need is a computer, but what can they possibly do and how easy is it for them to do that?
So Stuxnet in 2009 was one of the big drivers for Iran focusing more on having offensive cyber capabilities. And for those who don't know, Stuxnet was a malware family that got into the Iranian nuclear facilities. And what it did was essentially it made all of the control panels appear as if everything is operating as normal. But behind the scenes, it was spinning the centrifuges faster than they were intended to be. So they were burning out more quickly, which reduced their capabilities to enrich uranium. And so it was very advanced. It was very clear that Stuxnet was built by a nation state going after Iran. And when Iran identified this, they started to invest in offensive security operations, cyber operations. And so after that, around 2011, we started to see them to target financials in the U.S. And they actually targeted between 2011 and 2013. They completed DDoS attacks successfully against 46 different financial institutions in the U.S., resulting in billions of dollars in loss of revenue. And then in mid-2013, Iran was able to get into a SCADA system in the New York Dam system. And why this was critical is that the system itself had a very low risk. Worst case scenario, they could flood a couple of towns in Westchester, New York. Didn't really impact the New York City water supply, but what's scary about it is that it was the first time they were able to get into a SCADA system in the U.S., and more importantly, they were not very far from Indian Point, which is a huge nuclear power plant in New York.
Right. So that has some serious potential for the United States.
Absolutely. And so in 2016, the Justice Department of the United States indicted seven different individuals from Iran to show that we were not going to take this standing down. And from there, we've seen increases in their capabilities. They realized they had to get more advanced and be more proactive if they were going to effectively engage in cyber warfare. And so we've had a huge uptick in terms of the capabilities of Iran, as well as the activity coming out of it from a cyber perspective.
So on the United States side, how can they prepare against something like this? I mean, the cyber landscape's constantly changing. You know, Iran just has to change one or two different things. And, you know, that's a whole new game for the United States to defend against. So how are they preparing?
Absolutely. So the Iran actor groups, and there are about nine identified, I believe. They are notorious for using the most common way to get into a corporation or a federal entity, which would be phishing. Mm-hmm. Humans are the weakest link in our security stack, right? There's always going to be a need for someone to be entering a username and password. And once those credentials are compromised, they're essentially given the keys to the castle. And so one of the best ways that U.S. entities can prepare is to remind their users about how to defend themselves against phishing attacks, to be more vigilant, to put all of their users on high alert that these things may be coming in. And a lot of the Iranian activity and how the actors are known to behave is very well documented in the threat intelligence community. So the best thing you can do to prepare is read what's known about them, understand the avenues they're known to leverage, such as spear phishing, right? And making sure that you have mitigating controls and that you're on high alert looking for that kind of activity.
And is the United States doing enough at this point, or is there more they can possibly do?
Well, there's always more you can do,
yeah,
right?
Sure.
It's almost like playing whack-a-mole, it feels like. But I have to say, I've been very impressed with the response from the U.S. as a whole. We saw notification coming out of Department of Homeland Security almost immediately to warning all U.S. entities to be prepared that this was a real threat and we were most likely to see it. And having that sort of notification from the Department of Homeland Security, a very highly trusted source of information in the community, really helped the U.S. organizations prioritize this and understand that this is not something we can take lightly and we need to be prepared. And that high level of alert is what is ultimately going to be our best defense.
So let's move to talent a little bit. So threat intelligence arena, you need these analysts and people to come and do the jobs that you just described. I think one of the things that a lot of people know about is Malcolm Gladwell. He had this sort of theory about 10,000 hours to be an expert. You do something for 10,000 hours and then you're pretty darn good at it. So when it comes to threat intelligence, do people have time to wait to really get that whole amount of expertise to be a Malcolm Gladwell expert?
No, of course not. Right. So as everyone knows, there's a huge talent shortage within the industry. And threat intelligence is not necessarily a new concept, but in terms of security professionals, it is a relatively new vertical. And so there aren't a lot of people with experience in it. And we don't have the time to wait for them to become experienced. So what we need to do as an industry is find ways to empower them to leverage threat intelligence more effectively and to lower the barrier for entry.
And what does that necessarily mean? You know, how can we lower this barrier of entry and bring people in at a lower hour amount, right? Or get them maybe built up through elementary school or something like that, right?
Yeah, so I think we need to make threat intelligence in general more approachable. Right now, you know, there's a lot of information out there. There are so many known actor groups that have been identified that it can be a bit intimidating and it can feel overwhelming to consume all this information. But I think the thing we need to do is focus on knowing that we don't need to know everything. You just need to have access to it and you need to know where to search. And having tools like a threat intelligence platform to bring all of your intelligence into a single source of truth can help make that barrier for entry lower, right? If you have one place to go to get all of your information, it's a lot easier to understand what you're looking at and pull all the pieces together and see those connections.
And when it comes to the amount of people that are interested in this field, I mean, is there enough? You know, are there enough people that are really signing up for this sort of thing?
That's a tricky question. In terms of is there interest in the security industry as a whole, I would say yes.
Right.
However, a lot of that interest comes from the younger professionals. So they may not have all of the industry experience that a more advanced professional would. And so there's a lot more training that you have to conduct in order to make them proficient in being a defensive cybersecurity professional.
Right, right. Now, what are your thoughts on using automation? Because, I mean, you know, this is sort of the AI world that we're moving into. Defense Department's putting a lot of money into artificial intelligence to try and automate many of their processes. So is this something that we might be able to automate? And is it reliable if we do automate any of these things?
Automation is critical. Mm-hmm. In the threat intelligence space, there is a ton of information out there about what the known bad is. And the lowest barrier for entry, if you will, is being able to take that information about the known bad and being able to defend yourself. So putting in automated blocking, putting in automated detection into your environment, and then having professionals on the other side who can respond to those alerts and who know how to investigate. and what avenues to look through to find the known bad in your environment.
And so let's use this as a little bit of a segue into the next thing we want to talk about, which is the future of threat intelligence. You know, how is automation evolving at this point? You know, is it in a pretty primal state, or can we use it at higher levels?
Yeah, so threat intelligence as an industry in terms of the federal space has been around for a very long time in the intelligence community. But on the commercial side, it's a little bit newer. We only really saw threat intel as a vertical in security really take off in about 2015.
Mm-hmm.
And so the first generation of that, the first approach, if you will, to automating threat intelligence is the threat intelligence platform. And there are a variety of tools out there for that. And essentially a threat intelligence platform takes all of that information out there about the known bad and brings it into a single tool. And from there, you can send it to your security tools for the automated actions, right? So sending to your SIEM for automated detection, sending to your firewall and your proxies for automated blocking, sending known bad senders to your email gateways so you drop the emails before they make it to the end user. But we've grown beyond that. I would say the next generation of threat intelligence, which I would say emerged in around 2016 to 2017, is more around having detection engines. A SIEM is really great at giving you that forward protection, looking from this point forward from when we knew about it to have I seen it. But what's critical is being able to look backwards in time. Most of the time when these big public breaches happen, the information you need to be able to identify if you were impacted was relevant 6 months ago. And so you need to have the capabilities to go backwards in time and say, 6 months ago, was I impacted? And how Anomaly does that is through our detection engine called Match. And as indicators of compromise come into Match, it automatically searches going backwards in time. So when your CISO comes to you and says, hey, was I impacted? The answer is already sitting there.
Right.
And I think there's one more level to this, right? And this is, I think, where we're at today. And I would consider this the third generation. And that would be bringing it all together, taking your external threats, right, the threat intelligence component, and marrying it with your internal detection and having that permeate your entire security practices. And to help facilitate that, Anomaly introduced Lens this year, which uses natural language processing on any web page you're on to identify the known threats, your threat intelligence, your external information, but also to ask the question automatically, was I impacted? By dispatching searches to your Match instance to be able to answer the question immediately, did I see this in my environment ever? And having that capability is something I think every security team needs. Not only being able to answer, am I impacted, but more importantly, was I impacted?
And so when it comes to automation, how much human interaction is really needed with this kind of thing? Because, you know, DoD always talks about AI, and eventually the decision comes to the guy that has to pull the trigger, and you definitely want a human doing that. You know, how does that work within the cybersecurity realm? How much human intervention do you need within automation?
Yeah, so automation is absolutely critical, but at the end of the day, you need a human at the other end investigating, because you can only automate so much, which is great because then we'd probably be all out of jobs.
Right.
And so the important thing to think about when you're thinking about protecting yourself against the known bad is what we refer to as the pyramid of pain. And when you think about intelligence, it kind of grows from lowest fidelity to highest fidelity. And so things like file hashes, IPs, machine-readable intelligence, right? Things you can send to your tools for automated blocking. Those are actually the lowest fidelity pieces of information because they are so easy to change. Any malware worth its weight is going to be polymorphic. It's never going to use the same file hash twice. So if you're playing whack-a-mole, you're never going to be able to stop the bad guys. What you need to go is a layer above that. You need to get to the level of what we consider strategic intelligence. So these are things like being able to understand an actor's capabilities and knowing what tactics, techniques, and protocols they're known to leverage, because they're going to always be advancing their capabilities and always trying to evade detection. And if you can understand the ways that they can avoid your tools, you can also find ways to hunt them down in your environment, things that your security tools aren't going to catch. And so automation is critical in protecting against the low-hanging fruit, right? It's going to be pretty embarrassing if you get popped by something everybody knew was bad.
Right.
But to be truly protected, you need to take it to the level above, to that strategic level where you understand the mindset of the attacker. What are they going after and why? what are they doing to try and hide from you? And and that's where the human component comes in, because that's where you need to be able to look at things in a way that you can't with a security tool.
And I'd assume that the human aspect would help against things like false positives and looking into how things are hanging out within your system as well, right?
Absolutely. The human component is critical for tuning within automation. Most of the time when you first deploy any sort of security tool, there's going to be an initial higher false positive rate because it needs to be tuned for your environment. And so you need the humans to look at what's creating a lot of noise in your environment and to identify patterns within that so you can reduce your false positive rate. So for example, from a threat intelligence perspective, there are many sources of information, and not all of them are going to be right for your organization. And so the human component is being able to identify what is right for your organization. What kind of information do I care about? And the best way to find that out is by turning it all on and tuning back from there. Investigating the false positives, keeping track of what's a false positive in your environment, identifying trends within that so you can reduce the rate.
Okay, so now we're here in 2020 and we've hit maybe almost a third generation of automation, like you said, or maybe kind of going into that. What is the future of threat intelligence? Where are we going from here, and what should people keep their eye on?
Yeah, so as I mentioned before, right, we have to get above the operational intelligence into the strategic intelligence. And I think where the future of threat intelligence lies is automating the low level, the low hanging fruit, getting that detection out there so you have time to focus on what's truly important, which is an advanced persistent threat, right? Someone who has very advanced capabilities and is capable of evading your traditional security controls. And the best way to leverage strategic information is by associating it or looking at it from a model perspective, by modeling what these attackers are doing. One of the most popular ways right now is the MITRE ATT&CK framework. So the MITRE ATT&CK framework allows you to categorize different techniques based on what the actor is doing. And from there, you can take a look to see, you know, what are they how are they most likely to try and get into us? Once they get in, what are they most likely trying to do? How are they known to pivot in your environment to get to what they're looking for? And when you use the MITRE ATT&CK framework to map that out, you can actually overlay it in a nice visual using a heat map. And you can look at those heat maps and identify, okay, where are my mitigating controls around this? And it can help you decide where to beef up your mitigating controls. What do I need to focus my next year's budget on? I see that this is a huge attack vector for me in particular. I know that an actor group that is most likely to target me is known to leverage X, Y, and Z. So I need to make sure I have the controls in place to mitigate against that. The other thing I'd like to call out too is there's been a release of a new version of STIX 2.1. And STIX is a framework that facilitates sharing of threat intelligence at scale. Mm-hmm. And the new model offers a lot more flexibility and a lot more detail and the ability to capture relationships between pieces of information. And so by formalizing the ways that we can share information and ingest this shared information, it makes it much easier to track at scale and to action on. And so I think, you know, where is the future of threat intelligence? The future of threat intelligence is model first. It's focusing on identifying the tactics, techniques, and protocols, the actor groups, looking at that higher level and making sure that you're protected.
Would you say that companies are interested or willing to share their information? I know that the government has, you know, they've passed a law that says that, you know, you can give information and to the government and we'll try and use it the best way we can. And from what I've heard, it hasn't really been as robust as they were hoping. So you know, what's kind of the deal with that?
Yeah, so sharing is inherently a scary thing for most organizations in the U.S., both on the federal side as well as on the commercial side. Because when you share out threat intelligence, it's essentially admitting, I've seen this in my environment. So there's a very, very high fear of attribution back to them. But what I think the Department of Homeland Security has done really well with things like AIS, the Automated Indicator Sharing Feed, as well as the commercial side on the ISAC's Information Sharing and Analysis Center communities, we've made it easier to share in smaller communities. So there's less risk of attribution, it's a smaller vetted audience, and you feel more comfortable. I think Department of Homeland Security is critical to that as well. They've fostered a wonderful relationship with a lot of the civilian entities as well as the commercial side to make them comfortable to share. And the more that we share with each other, the better we are all able to protect ourselves. Ultimately, a lot of the threats facing any one organization is facing many organizations. And the more that we're willing to share with each other, the better our global protection can be.
Sharing is caring.
Sharing is caring.
Well, Jill, I think that's about all the time we have today. Thank you so much for joining us.
I greatly appreciate the time. This was wonderful.
And once again, I'd like to thank my guest, Jill Cagliostro. She's the product manager at Anomaly. I'm your host, Scott Massioni, and you're listening to the series Security Strategies in Government, sponsored by Anomaly on Federal News Network.